Hello and welcome to another CG Garage episode number 25. Gina's with me. There have been some complaints that I have not mentioned Gina in the podcast in a while, so I figured might as well just get Gina in the podcast for a little bit. Are you okay with that, Gina?
I am okay with that.
Okay, good. So this podcast features Lux Studios. I had a recording with them while I was in Stuttgart during FMX. They are a really great group. Gina, what do you, can you tell me or tell the audience about Lux Studios?
So Lux Studios, they've done some really great work. So their trailer for Manu the Swift.
Yeah, that's a feature animation they're working on right now. There isn't, unfortunately, we can't share that trailer because they don't have it online, but we did get to see it while at FMX, and it is really cool. And they're going to be talking a lot about it and about what it takes to make something like that, including the financing and the writing the story and pitching and how to actually get it produced, which is really, really cool. And hearing that, and it's a very small group of people doing it, so it's really kind of interesting. What are some of the other projects they worked on, Gina?
They worked on White House Down and Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yep, and they talk about both of those things as well. Right. Obviously, White House Down is a Roland Emmerich film, and if you know anything about working on Roland Emmerich films, he loves to work with German VFX companies because he's German. And so we talk about Roland Emmerich as well. And then also, working on Grand Budapest Hotel and what that was like, because a lot of that was done practically, but it was a lot of CG done and sort of the trick of how to make that all look in a similar way. Fantastic talk with them. I met with Andrea, I think it's either Andrea or Andrea. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce her name, but she is one of the heads of the studios, and she's really nice. Also happens to be an ex-architect, by the way, as many of us are. And Christian, who is also there, and he is really fantastic to talk to. Lovely conversation, and hopefully you guys all enjoy it.
And we'd also just like to thank everyone, including Lux Studios, who came out and spoke at V-Ray Days at FMX.
Yes, thank you very much, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Yeah.
So how long have you been in this building?
We started in this building since 2008. It was exactly, after Christmas.
Right.
It used to be an older church, Coptic church.
And this was a church?
Yes.
Ah.
We are on sacred grounds here.
Yes.
And as it has helped so far. We moved in just right after Christmas with the kitchen and the table. And then just after Christmas time, we set up the computers and the networks and everything, like the furniture for the workplaces.
And I overheard you say when we were here that you used to be an architect.
Oh, me? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I started in architecture and I wanted to go into visualization.
Right.
Because I was totally impatient to drawing everything by hand. It was just too tedious. And it started with all the computer graphics and Speedicon and everything like that. And then we moved on to other fields of visualization, I think. And the architects were a little bit slow on it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I did that too.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah. And it's kind of a joke on the podcast a little bit because everyone says, well, I actually used to start in architecture. There's so many people that are architects in this field. So it's really kind of funny that a lot of us did that. Because it was about visualization, about spaces, and about computers, right at that time, it was. Did you do architecture as well?
No. I went direct into the film business.
Oh, you were. So you come from the film business.
I came direct from the school to the film academy. So
you're a film academy graduate.
Yeah, we both. So we met
you're
there.
Both. And, okay. So did you do that after architecture?
Yeah, I did a postgraduate study at a film academy in Ludwigsburg.
Uh-huh.
And this is where we both met.
Ah, okay. Well, that's really cool.
I have two graduates.
Well, I was fascinated by the story of the Film Academy about how that whole place works and how hard it is to get in. And then the fact that you have to, when you go there, you kind of have to already know everything. You're just like learning how to do it for real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
He was playing actually with a 3D game with, I think, one of the first Max versions ever released. He did something like a game for a presentation to get into the academy.
It was not direct for the academy. No, it was. No? I was. I liked computer games as every boy at this age.
Right.
I still like it today, but. Right. And then at school time, a second a friend of me and we developed a computer game, and the kind of mist at this game was very common at this days.
Right.
With still background images and some thing we have to do inside of it, and he did all the coding for the game, and I did the images for it.
Right.
And I didn't know really what to do with that skills.
Yeah.
So I wrote a letter to Silicon Graphics at this time and asked them if they have any suggestions. What can I do with that knowledge? How can I go forward in my life? And they said, oh, go to the Film Academy.
Oh, well, that's a good idea. Wow.
Because they had lots of computers from Silicon Graphics there.
And so what year was this, approximately?
95, 94, 94, around this.
Wow. So Film Academy was already doing stuff back then. So
really amazing. Had good computer equipment at this time.
Right.
Yeah. And I went to some German, how is it called here, an institute where they
counseling for professions. What kind of profession you could choose later?
Yeah, right. Career counseling.
Career
counseling, yeah.
And I went to this one and I asked them too, what can I do? And is the Film Academy good for me? Because I was not really sure. And they said, that doesn't make sense. They only take 5 students per year or something. So they have no chance to go there. They told me directly.
Yeah, but
so I was not sure. I was more unsure after
why
that.
Why not try?
Exactly. Well, he did try.
Yeah, he did try, exactly. And I don't like it when people say, well, you know, you're never going to do that. It's like, why? That's just wrong. So, give it a try, and if it doesn't work, then try something else.
I gave it a try.
exactly.
And it was worth it.
And I was selected for it, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the sad thing about the story is that Silicon Graphics told him to go to Film Academy, and what he did as a student at Film Academy was convincing our, director
to
throw out the Silicon Graphics stations because they're much too expensive at that time, and then move on with Macs and regular PCs.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. I know exactly what you mean. How long after that did you guys start forming this studio here? I guess it's 2008.
2000. Yeah, no, here we went into it.
Must have started before that, exactly.
Yeah, 2006.
Okay.
The end of 2006.
And what were you guys doing between 2000, when you graduated in 2006?
I was working at different companies as a freelancer. So I was at Scanline and Ambient Entertainment.
Okay.
And different other companies. So I get a lot of experience at different companies, and after a while we decided let's try it by ourselves.
On-set supervisor.
It was a great time, and we still have a good relationship to those companies. Actually we are talking to them if we could collaborate and for my new
some possibility well.
If there are some possibilities to do something in that area, so that's still there's still a good relationship to the founders of their companies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my time after graduation at Film Academy, I was doing the first projects for the industries here.
Sure.
So we were working, for the car industry. I don't want to mention any names.
Sure.
In Stuttgart.
Right.
So
this
is also the reason why we started everything in Stuttgart. Mm-hmm. And that was 2006 that we formed the company together.
Right.
And before that, it was just, for me, it was individual documentaries, visual effects work for any type of commercial for the industry around.
And you
here.
Did a lot of on-set as well, too, right?
Yes, I was working as an on-set supervisor as well.
Uh-huh.
Only trick was, since I was also coming from the background of architecture, they sometimes asked me if I could just right away do a little bit set work.
So
that was a right nice fit, really.
Yeah, so you basically were an art director at the same time.
I know,
Well, that was cool. So that's nice because you still get to practice your architecture background as well, which is funny because when I graduated architecture school, there were two of us
I went to a school called Rice University, and it was very, very small graduate class. They had very selective, kind of like Film Academy. So there was only 14 of us accepted at the class. And two of us went into film after a while. And one of them was my friend Christy, and she became an art director. And I became a VFX guy. So it was kind of funny at the same time. Yeah, mm-hmm. It does fit very well for architects to go into that role.
I think so as well.
Okay, so when you started in 2006, what were some of the projects you got started on back then?
Oh, it was mainly something like for the industry, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
Some visual effects for some commercials, for some fairs.
And then you guys got into film after that. You guys started doing some big film work, right?
Yeah. At first, it was TV work, pretty much, in Germany. Okay. So we were doing, something like the Big Wall and how the Forbidden City was built.
Oh, so documentary style stuff.
No, it was more like reenactment stuff.
Reenactment, okay.
Miniseries that are very popular nowadays.
Yeah.
And it was just before the Olympics and Beijing, China.
Yeah.
And so that got us started pretty much. And it was still in our living room at that time.
Yeah.
With five artists.
Yep, a lot of studios have started in living rooms.
Yeah, I heard many of them started in
garage.
We didn't have one, so that's why we had to start in the living room.
Exactly. And then you guys moved to this space, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And you guys made it really, really nice. Like I love how you turned a second floor in. That was really kind of cool. I did that.
And we had a great chance to rebuild all the electric elements here, the network things, so we could really design the network how we need it. So this was a great chance.
And you also kept a kitchen, so you make it feel very much like a living space, which is also something that not everyone always does. So it's really kind of nice that people can feel, they must feel like they can just come here and hang out in a way, right?
We cook there in the kitchen sometimes twice a week.
Yeah. Twice a week,
So for the whole crew sometimes.
We have team lunches.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I have to say we have quite a few of our artists love to eat and they also love to cook.
Mm-hmm.
So we have little groups where we have maîtres and we have helpers.
Oh.
And then we have a bundle of two and then they're cooking for the whole team.
Oh, that's really cool.
But it depends on the size of the team and the project we are running.
Yeah, when you guys are
very
busy, it's going to be hard to...
When it's really full and crowded here, then the Töpfe...
Pots and pans.
The pots
they
are
don't
too small,
the sizes.
So we cannot put enough pasta into it, so then we have
exactly.
to skip it.
Right. Well, that's cool. When I was working at Method Studio, before they merged with Riot, so it was still actually a kind of a small boutique shop, but they would actually do, there was a lot of flames in there, and so a lot of commercials being done, and a lot of clients all the time that are there, and they would do, in the kitchen, a full catered lunch every day, because they would invite the clients out and the clients would eat and the artists would eat all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
So it turned into like this big family get together and everyone would socialize. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first places I saw it where they really kind of encouraged the artists to, be in front of the client and talk to them. And they really got their skills in terms of how to talk to clients and how to be, because sometimes VFX artists are not necessarily the best people to talk to clients, but they learned that skill naturally that way, which was kind of a nice thing, I think, as well.
It's true. Yeah. It also adds to the atmosphere between the team members,
Yeah. And everyone felt welcome and there was an equal, which was nice. And I think sometimes the clients really appreciated it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the features that you guys worked on was also White House Down, I noticed, which is a Roland Emmerich film, right? My first movie I worked on was a Roland Emmerich film as well. So
which one?
I worked on Day After Tomorrow.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a great movie.
That's one of my favorites, I have to say.
Great one.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I was, as an architect, I was working at Gensler and a friend of mine called me and he was saying, what, we have to build all of New York City. We could use a couple of architects. So I worked on that one. But I was actually sitting next to, the guy I sat next to was a German guy named Rainer Gumbusch. I don't know if you know who he is.
We know
him. Yeah,
we
know. So I sat next to Rainer. He was building the ships for Day After Tomorrow. So I know all the German mafia in Hollywood, where they're all of the VFX guys are all together, and Matthias Wittmann and all of and of course, I know Volker used to come by all the time, Volker Engel. So I know all the Germans. They're really, really nice guys. It was very interesting because obviously, because of Film Academy and because of a bunch of the other things, there's a lot of VFX talent here in Stuttgart, which I think is really, really cool. And it does spread around the world every now and then, but also there's a lot of people that probably like to stay here and work in their own city. And so tell me a little bit about working on White House Down then.
Well, actually, I would just like to add a little story about the Roland Emmerich and the German guys over in Hollywood. When I was at Film Academy, whenever you meet somebody in the tram or something, they would always ask you, oh, you're studying at the place, you know, at the Roland Emmerich Academy. And it's so funny because he was just drawing on some talent after the first graduates graduated to incorporate them in, I think it was Independence Day at that time.
So, yeah.
And this is why the Film Academy got the label of being Roland Emmerich's Academy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's,
well, that's
funny.
That's, he studied there, which is not correct. He was
he
in Munich.
In Munich. Yeah.
He studied in Munich, but he got all the guys from this
exactly.
area.
Exactly.
That's correct, yeah.
Kind of collected a lot of students or graduates from the Film Academy. To work on White House Down was really thrilling because when I studied as a postgraduate at the Film Academy, all the visual effects movies that Roland did were amazing. You know, all the effects that were done for it, that was just a dream to work for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when they were asking us to bid for it, I thought they were just trying out the prices. We kept chasing Volker and Mark for a few years at FMX and kept showing them our work and hoped that one time they would just draw back on our talent and ask us to do a little work for them.
Right.
But when they were actually asking for some sequences on White House Down for Roland Emmerich, I couldn't really believe that they mean it.
Really? But so, but you were excited about that,
absolutely.
Obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you guys got, how many shots did you guys work on?
54.
54 shots?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the White House and the helicopter shots I saw.
Correct.
The full mall.
Yeah, exactly.
The beginning of the movie, the first six or seven minutes of the movie.
Okay.
So that's... And it's not so much shots, but many of those shots were...
Doesn't matter. If it's a Roland Emmerich movie, one shot is like 10
shots. Were very long. So sometimes they are 20 seconds per shot. So that's the reason that it's still 6 minutes.
But yeah, Roland shots are tough. So that's the 54 shots for Roland. It's like 540 shots for most other things. He really knows what he wants. What I also like about Roland is especially his trailers, because he cuts the trailers himself, kind of unique. And that's why he always tends to create such big buzz about his stuff, because he knows exactly how to sell his movie. And he does a really good job of that too. He's a nice guy. Roland.
Yeah, he knew exactly for our work what he wanted.
Oh,
so
yeah,
there
yeah.
was not one situation where we worked in the wrong direction or something. Or then he said, go back. No, it was always clear from the beginning what he wanted. And
Volker was your overall supervisor?
Volker and Mark,
Mark Weigert really and
great guys.
Volker is very good at interpreting exactly what needs to happen. And
he's super prepared, and it was the best experience in our company history, I would say.
Yeah, it was not necessarily the same one Day After Tomorrow, because Volker was not the VFX supervisor, it was someone else, and it wasn't as successful as you were describing, let's just put it that way. But I think that Volker was definitely... What I love about Volker is that he used to come, when there was a martini night at DD, every Friday they would have martini night at DD, and he would just come by and say hi and hang out with us and talk to us like regular guy. And he had a DeLorean...
I heard about that. I've never tried it.
And his DeLorean, the best part of the DeLorean is the license plate said VFX ID4 on the back of it. And he would say, hey, you guys want to go on a ride in my DeLorean? And he's like, yeah, let's go ride it.
Let's go to the future.
So he was he was pretty funny about that.
What was really rewarding about working with them is that they had such a well-prepared sequence work for us to start with, you know? So we actually exactly knew what would happen and what they wanted in terms of timing and where we would be looking at.
You know, it was all pre-vised?
It was pretty much pre-vised.
And you just had that, you knew exactly what your shots were and you had to know.
We knew the length of the shots, we knew where we were looking at, but what we didn't know at first, of course, was that we were not only to place, you know, full CG helicopters in front of, you know, shot live action plates, but that also the background couldn't be shot because they didn't get allowance for flying so low.
Of course.
And so close to the White House.
Right.
So at first we were doing the bidding, and at that process...
For only the helicopter.
Exactly. Yeah. Only the helicopters on live action plates.
Yeah. Lesson learned, if anyone gives you shots and they're shot in Washington, D.C., you pretty much have to do CG backgrounds.
Now we know it.
Yeah. I heard the same story from... from the guys at ILM when they were working on Captain America, and they're like, mm-hmm. yeah, we had to pretty much couldn't get any of the shots that we thought we were going to get on the background, so we had to redo it all in CG. So yeah, it's a tough one though, because yeah. of getting those clearances. That's especially true. Yeah,
and also, you know, when we were to do the bid, we were discussing the mall, and then we looked it up, of course, in Google mm-hmm. Maps, and mm-hmm. but we didn't have a notion on how big it actually is. Of course, you can take the measures. We're right. architects, right?
Right, sure.
So we really know what we're talking about. Right. But I still remember the moment when we set foot on Washington, D.C., and we just kind of saw everything, mm-hmm. and how big it was, and we were there for taking, you know, reference pictures and textures, and mm-hmm. just blew me away.
Right.
I just was kind of, my heart just dropped, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it was really massive, yeah.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, we also thought that we can use a drone for doing some.
Yeah,
picture. We already bought it, right. a small one.
Yeah,
and that was did our first test deals. Yeah, yeah. And then we asked the production what they think about it. We have a drone with us, and if we could do some pictures from some of the
drones. Yeah.
Yeah, drone pictures. And they said, no, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, someone landed a drone on the White House.
Yeah.
So,
I heard about it.
Yeah, he's like, really? So obviously. Someone found a way, but I don't think they did it very legally, though. No.
I think Julia Fry, who was the visual effects producer, working together with Volker, and she was dealing with all the bidding stuff and uh-huh. advising on several shots. She just told me it's not such a good idea.
Yeah.
At first, she thought I think we were joking, but we were dead serious.
Right.
We really wanted to save some, you know, time mm-hmm. to collect all the data.
Yeah.
And well. We thought that it might not be such a good idea because we didn't want to do a visual effect in jail.
Right. I remember the story. I was talking to Lupa Kaur, and he was working on X-Men. The new one. What's it called? Days of Future Past. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was shot, obviously, in 1970s DC. And they were allowed to shoot, but... what they would do is they would shoot the shot and then they had to show it to the Secret Service. Ah. And the Secret Service says, yes, you can keep it. No. And they would take it off. And they said, okay, if I can't keep it, can you tell me what I can't shoot? No, I can't tell you that. Try again.
Okay.
Nice advice.
It's like, oh. You know, so yeah, so sometimes it's just worth so doing it in CG.
The White House needs our own VFX department.
Yes, they should just have a VFX department so at the White
prepare
House.
Prepare the shots for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That
true.
Would be a good one.
Yeah.
So cool. All right, before I move on to the animation you guys are doing, which it's a totally new thing, I want to talk a little bit about Grand Budapest Hotel, because that was really kind of an interesting work for you guys as well.
So that's true.
Yeah, that was a lot. That was more than 54 shots on that one, right? So how many shots did you guys work on there?
Well, it was in general, it was something like close to 450 or something like that. But there were really rather small ones too, like timings and blinking reanimation of actors.
Right.
So let's not count those. Mm-hmm. So just for the real shots, I think it was something like 370
okay.
that we did in our studio. And the special thing about it was that we were combining stop-motion skiers, you know, like stop-motion puppets that mm-hmm. were really like tube frames and everything. And then we had miniatures that were built in Babelsberg in Berlin
uh-huh.
That were shot on set. And then we had the actors, of course, in front of green screens sometimes as plates. And then we had to do a lot of digital matte paintings to match that.
Okay. Well, it had a very specific look to it. Obviously, it's Wes Anderson, so he has a specific way of wanting to look things. And it doesn't necessarily always have to look completely real, but it has to look in a specific style, which in his case was very passionate about miniatures, right? So even your CG sort of had to live in that miniature world, which is probably a little bit more challenging in a way, because all of us, we're used to, like, it's got to look real, look to scale, but the scale is very different, right? So what Absolutely was that like?
True. You know, always, you know, do it photoreal. Everybody who's in the CG world right. knows that it's very hard to achieve, and usually you kind of have a little backdrop if you see it very close enough and stuff like that.
Right.
And we know that we can't really rebuild the full reality to 100%.
Okay.
But that's usually the measurement if visual effects are really good and believable, that mm-hmm. they look totally real.
Right.
Versus the opposite, just right after handing over White House Down show and all the approval of the shots, we had about 2 months, and then we started the pre-production for the Grand Budapest Hotel mm-hmm. and we were doing the first layouts. And of course, all of our eyes and all of our artist team were were trained to go, you know, when you're doing digital matte painting, for instance, of something like the mountains, you would go for nice perspectives, nice lighting to see the volumes of the mountains, to have the snow glow, all of this stuff. And this is what the first layouts would look like. And then we handed those over, and then we got nice feedbacks, notes like, you know, oh, you know, it looks pretty nice and it's impressive, but we're not going for Inception.
Right, right. They wanted something very much that.
Or Day After Tomorrow, right, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So they wanted to dial back and do something that is uniquely in the head of Wes Anderson. I think for us it was an experience of learning how he actually perceives his vision for the movie.
Yeah.
And I remember that we were talking about colors a lot and about, you know, keep it that you can see that those are Star Trek animated puppets.
Sure.
Don't put too much motion blur in there. Have the flags wiggle a little bit. You should really see that it's stop motion Trek. He doesn't like the CG world.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Well, yeah, he doesn't like it. What's also interesting is that, I mean, exactly like you said, when you see a Wes Anderson film, you know it's his style. Obviously, he's very strong and makes sure that it looks like one of his films. But it's very hard to describe what that style is. So, I'm thinking off the top of my head. Well, how would I describe Rushmore? How would I describe? You kind of have to see it. And so I'm sure that it's the same case. Like when he's trying to verbalize it, I guess it's very hard to interpret at the same time.
Yeah, it's true.
And so you guys did some of the toboggan stuff, right? Where they're coming down the hill. And what was that like to work on some of those shots? Were kind of interesting?
Well, actually, it's from the content. It feels a little bit like he's mocking at all the James Bond chases downhill.
Yes.
And I remember quite a few movies where it's kind of, you know, one by one, you could actually edit it next to each other and then see how it works. And so he's a big Bond fan.
Oh, yeah. Well, who isn't a Bond fan at our age, right?
Yeah. But I'm more a fan of the old ones.
Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. I don't know exactly how old you are, but that was me. It was my parents were always very horrified because I said the Roger Moore ones were kind of the ones that I remember. And my parents were like, what are you talking about? Sean Connery. It's like, now no one even knows who we're talking about.
That's true. Yeah. I just remember on the downhill chase sequence that it was really, really special to find out that he has paid attention to every little detail on, you know, something like the stop trick skier that was maybe containing 3% of the image space. And he was really talking about, you know, how much gray, how much brown, how much shadow, shadows on the ground, traces in the snow itself, putting on extra snow so that you can really access and understand the speed of the motion.
Sure.
And some of it really should look artificially correct in his vision,
right?
And be interpreted like if it would be a painting or something like that. But of course, a painting isn't moving. So in the end, he was also talking to us about, you know, layers of fog that kind of reveal scenes and show a little bit more of the depth, and then it's closing again, then it's opening again. So we got many notes on percentages of density of fog. We had to add a few snowflakes, flakes that were, you know, hitting us in the face as we are doing a POV or something like that. And in the full end, before we were really handing over the finals, he was adding a little real effect on the lens, you know, like a frost on the outside and some, you know, extra dirt on it. And when the snowflakes are hitting the lens, that you would see that it's melting. So it was a little funny that at first he was going off into the artistic and artificial side. And then later for the finish, he would add those realistic effects on it.
Right.
But it was very interesting experience too. I mean, I'm a big Wes Anderson film fan. I really love the movies that he's making. Fantastic Mr. Fox, Rushmore, of course, and the Moonrise Kingdom. I really like that too.
Yeah. Darjeeling Limited is my personal favorite of him.
Which one is this?
Darjeeling Limited.
Limited,
that's the train movie.
I'm debating whether it's Rushmore or Royal Tenenbaums, but both of those are just brilliant movies as well. But he's definitely, like you said, a very interesting guy. And so I want to move on a little bit because I want to speak a lot about this new thing you guys are doing. So tell me about this animation you guys are working on. this feature animation. They're debating which one is going to actually start to speak.
I've talked so much already.
Yeah.
Come on, Christian, later on, everybody's going to say, a woman never shut up.
It's official true.
Okay. At the moment, we're doing an animated feature, which is called Manu, the Swift. Manu is his name of the main character. Swifts are certain type of birds. Mm-hmm. They're pretty small. They're very agile, very flexible. Mm-hmm. They live in the air, and they even sleep up in the air.
Yep.
They can take curves very fast, and he's picked up by seagulls because he's an orphan.
Right.
And
so a swift raised by seagulls.
Exactly. Right. So it's a little bit the ugly duckling story. But also a little later, it becomes a Romeo and Juliet story because at a certain moment in time, you know, during the midpoint, a little later, he's exiled from the seagull colony because he tried very hard to become a good seagull. Mm-hmm. But of course, he can't really succeed because he's not built that way. And at a certain moment in time, he's not fulfilling the score that they would wanted him to do, you know, like guarding the eggs at night so that the rats can't come and chase them.
Right.
And he didn't fulfill that. And so they sent him to exile.
Ah.
And at that time in the movie, he's kind of losing his family, including his brother, who's a seagull. Mm-hmm. And he's looking for new friends. And then he's going to the other sides where he meets the Swifts for the first time. And he's falling in love with one of them.
Right. Which is a beautiful story. But I think there was something that was very interesting you were telling me earlier about some of the inspiration of that story in terms of where it comes from in France. Tell me about France and about Nice. Because first of all, I'm a huge fan of Nice. I've been there several times. I love it. But tell me a little bit about that story, because I think it's a really nice inspirational story of what drove this in a way.
Well, there's a situation that we have the Mediterranean Sea, which is, you know, like the frontier between Northern Africa and Southern Europe.
Right.
And at the moment, there's a lot of trouble going with that because there's many Northern Africans who would like to enter Europe because they really want to survive and have a piece of the, you know, the wealth of Northern Europe.
And we have like that in America as well.
I know that, yeah. And so it's a very, it's a story that is transferable to many countries in the
of
world.
Of course.
Yeah. And especially our story is based at the time, 1963, when there was the stop of the war between, in Algeria.
In Algeria,
and the French people invited them to come over and join the mainland in France.
Right.
And Algeria became independent. And there were many of the immigrants, new immigrants from Northern Africa, coming to Nice, for instance, because, of course, the southern coast is as, you know, close to the northern coast of Africa as can be.
Right.
If you're moving to the Bretagne or to the north part of the sea, or it's quite different. So they chose rather the south, which is obvious.
Right.
And so when you go visit Nice, there's many layers of societies that you can observe.
Mm-hmm.
And those two societies, or maybe there's even more of them, they don't really mingle. So there's the Arabs, the Northern Africans, and there's the white French who always feel like they own the land and they just belong there. And the others are the intruders a little bit.
Right.
And it's very special how they deal with that. And I think it's transferable to Berlin or to London or to New York, just anywhere.
So anywhere. So those two societies, the seagulls and the swift, kind of represent some of those, that split in society in a sense, right?
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah. And did you guys, where does the story come from?
It was 2007, I think, when we had an in-between break between projects and went on a sailboat and had a small stop in Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked up to this big rock in the middle of the city, or in the harbor near. And there's a small waterfall, and we watched lots of seagulls standing on top of the waterfall and jumping into the air and glide over the waterfall. And it looked like they do training for flying or for sailing.
Oh, okay.
For sailing.
For training their chicks, I guess.
Yeah, correct. And on the other side of the rock, we saw small little birds living in the caves, in the darker areas. I am not sure if they are really seagulls in our story.
Swift.
But smaller birds which flew around corners very fast and not so elegant, but more artistic in a certain way.
Right.
And we watched them for hours, I think. And I was always thinking about a story behind it and made some notes on my PDA at this time, very, very old PDA. And I was thinking, and it was really a great time. For 3 or 4 hours, we were on the rock and watched them and developed a little bit brainstorming for the story. And then we went at home and the PDA was broken or something, as I lost all the my notes.
Oh no.
So I tried to write it down with a pen again.
Right.
But I lost a little bit and I was frustrated, and I put it into on the table, and I didn't watch on the notes anymore for a long time. And after a while, Andrea came up and said, hey, we should do something with that. And so She put the notes back and we started thinking again and developed a script out of it. And
well, first we did the treatment and we sent in the treatment and was rejected by the funds, local funds around here.
Okay.
And then we were sent to a workshop where we could, discuss with other people that are developing scripts.
Yeah.
And then we had Chris Tangrove as our mentor, who's also a very good writer on UK TV series.
Mm-hmm.
And he was giving us very good advices to whose story it is and what the real content is that we want to tell.
Yep.
And how many characters we really need for that. Maybe we could just throw out a few to really make it more clear what we want to tell.
Right.
And so with that in the luggage, we just came back and handed in the funding again.
Right.
And that worked out the second time.
Oh, well, wow. You only did it twice. That's good.
Yeah, it was with a lot of help of our friends in that case.
Yeah. I've seen from a friend of mine who has his script sent back 12, 15 times. But it's because we wanted to do it for this. Like, you know what? And he comes back, he's like, oh, this is great. Unfortunately, we abandoned the idea. Now we do want to do a TV series. So can you rewrite it as a TV series? But that's really great. And in fact, you guys got it and you got some funding and you started this basically an animation studio now, right?
Yeah. Well, we kind of hopped over from visual effects and animation.
We are parallel now.
You're parallel now. Yeah, so you have Lux Studio and Lux Film, right?
Lux Film is the production company.
Yeah.
And Lux Studio is the studio which produces it at the moment, or the pre-production for it.
Right.
But we still stay on the visual effects side. So
okay.
Actually, we have just added the new skills of feathers and fur and animation.
Right.
Of course, we did the animation of the helicopters as well and many other things. You know, it doesn't matter if it's dinosaurs or anything else. It's always
not comparable,
But at the moment, we, of course, have a lot more character animation than we used to do because of creating that, original content.
Right. And I got the chance to see some teasers today and it looks really, really cool and really amazing.
Thank you.
And what I think is really incredible too, because there's a lot of work you guys have done, and I know you have a lot more to go, so I'm not certainly, but you're a studio of about 20 people, right?
Yeah.
And you're doing a 20, and you grow up and
we
down
grew
with
up
freelancers.
To 30.
But just the fact that you have the ambition to do a full feature animation with that level of size studio is pretty, pretty ambitious. How long have you guys worked on this so far?
Well, we have done script development for a year and a half.
Okay.
One author who is German first and who has studied with us at Film Academy. So the networks are really precious.
Yes, yeah.
And then we send that out to Phil Parker, who was working for Artman, for instance, for script writing, especially for animation. So he's an animation script doctor expert.
Gotcha, yeah.
And after that, we really went into pre-production. So we were doing the character design. There are some maquettes sitting over here where we really were building them and sculpting them. And then we put them into the 3D version as soon as we entered pre-production and did a first trailer. And that probably took something like a year, pre-production.
Sure.
And by now, we have 70% of all the storyboard animatics done.
Okay.
And there's about 25% still missing.
Sure.
5% are sitting and waiting to be scanned.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, the script done, and it's just being back translated into English again.
Okay.
And then we should do the sound recording so that we can do the animation directly.
And you guys have to get a cast for the sound as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. We're looking for the right American cast. We need two famous names to sell it well.
Okay.
And about a year from now backwards, we found a sales agent, world sales agent,
okay.
That was, you know, going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have sold quite a few territories already.
Oh, great.
But
great.
The in-between step was that the first funding, the pre-production funding, allowed us to do this in-house teaser.
Oh, right.
Right.
And
that we started the...
Yeah, you almost have to convince people, here's a
yes,
taste
exactly,
of what it
correct.
Is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this helped a lot. So from with the funding of the MFG, here the regional funding,
right.
Allowed us to take the step and to start to build up the pipeline for mm-hmm. it. And at this time, we had our first designs for the characters, for example. And after this first teaser, we made a complete redesign for the characters,
okay.
for example. So we kept the backgrounds, but we started from scratch again for
the characters.
For the characters, because mm-hmm. they were too clumsy and
right.
not elegant enough. And so we rendered all the scenes again
right.
for the teaser mm-hmm. and made it newer and better.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
The plan is not that we're doing with 20 or 40 people a full feature animated full CG movie. It's more like the plan that we are doing all the planning
mm-hmm.
After the example of Volker and Mark
mm-hmm.
that we had the honor to work with,
right.
That we do all the thinking and all the planning first with the animatic and all the storyboarding,
sure.
so that everybody who will get the share of the work of our co-production countries, which are at the moment France and Canada,
mm-hmm.
That it's prepared in a way that they can just go ahead and start.
So you'll basically be handing out some of the work to those other
exactly.
companies, right?
Yeah.
So well, that's good. Hub. Yeah, but it's still you're not going to get to the 500 1,000 people that it normally takes to do one of these things, right?
Yeah.
So that's really. But you guys have already accomplished quite a bit of it just on your own at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think what's really rewarding for our team is that they can see what they can achieve even with small team size, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're always confronted with so big, huge, massive companies, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you have 1,000 people, double negative or whatever you mm-hmm. name it, you know? All
mm-hmm.
of those Pixar, of course, is our sure. biggest, you know, that we would like to live up to.
Right.
And we have visited Pixar and we saw it from the inside. It's a fantastic place and
mm-hmm.
we really loved it. But of course, we are much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really good that we can understand that when you're a smaller team, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are out of the picture and that you're not capable of doing big things.
Right.
It's like on my t-shirt at the moment, it just says, even big stars start tiny, you know? Sometimes
yeah.
it's the spark that it's needed and the planning and the scheduling and,
yep.
and the thinking and the heart and the content and the passion that you later on can take to bigger vendors and then ask them to do some of the work.
Right.
And of course, because there are so many people, they are very fast in turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
We just take a little longer to doing that. But in comparison, what we did on White House Down, for instance, those 6.5 minutes, there were so many people that were asking us on how big the team was. And
mm-hmm.
we just told them, you know, we were all together over time on those 9 months period.
Mm-hmm.
We were maybe 35 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they said, it's amazing what you did with those little teams, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe if you're a smaller team, sometimes you're also more efficient because you don't lose so much time at work by waiting for feedback. I think
yeah.
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I get the feedback is one thing, and it's also the managing of the teams. Because as a supervisor, it's like if I have a team of 35 lighters, it's just horrible because mm-hmm. I gotta just sort of generalize everything and treat everyone like a button pusher. But if I have a team of 5 people, we can work together much easier, you know.
That's
and it
true.
Becomes a lot and especially if there's only 5 people, I'm gonna hire the 5 best people I know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so
true.
I know if when you have it's I don't know 25 good people, I know 5 good people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier sometimes to sort of focus your team and your attention, and you get to know exactly the strengths of everyone, right? With you know your small team of 35 people, it's like this guy's really good at this, I'm gonna make him do this, and this girl's really good at this, I'm gonna make her do that. So it makes it much easier to focus your
yeah.
attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they know exactly the direction and understood it.
Right.
They moving forward, even without much feedback from our side, we got pretty good results sometimes, and then we have to add and
right.
Correct a few things. But the team itself is really great in going forward with a vision and what we prepared for them and told
yeah.
them to do.
So, yeah, we're doing key scenes, yeah. And then they are a very experienced and very good team. They're well educated, and they're not only good at one thing. Most of them have studied at Film Academy or another film school, mm-hmm. so that they really have a broad overview, mm-hmm. and that really helps, because as soon as you have defined the look and the character design, and they know the mm-hmm. story, they have read the script, mm-hmm. They even did some dialogue trainings with us so that everybody knows what we are talking about, just right. find out how long it takes to say all of these right. dialogues, and so they're totally living the story.
Right.
They really know what they're doing, and...
So, yeah.
Shall I open it?
Oh, is it someone? Oh, okay. Hold on. We'll pause. It's okay.
It's too open here. Okay. We need a quiet room.
So just as I said, the team is really capable of catching what we have in mind and what we are aiming for. And of course, that's always a process, like what we had to learn with Wes Anderson.
Right.
And but still, they really know what we are looking for, and they have very good suggestions. And we are open to their suggestions as well, because they are so good at their work.
They need not so much supervision. So we deliver them with reference images and the storyboards and everything else. And
yeah.
They're pretty good in transform the vision okay. into a very first good rough version, and
right,
yeah,
right,
this
right,
helps
right.
a lot.
Well, I want to the last thing I want to talk about is about FMX a little bit, because mm-hmm. I think we're here for FMX, which is great. I know, and you guys gave some great talks for us, which is really really awesome over at at our V-Ray Days event. But the first time I met you guys was actually over at the French Institute, right? So, which was really cool, because you guys have been doing every night at 10 o'clock, you go to the French Institute and we have cocktails and we listen to music, and it's a lot of fun. So tell us a little bit about how you guys got involved in FMX at this point.
As Film Academy students, I still remember the times when we were responsible for hosting our speakers.
Oh, right.
So it was our thing to really get, you were drawing the names, basically, that right. you would like to host. Mm-hmm. And then it was our, idea to really show them around in Stuttgart, help them a little bit with the Germans, because not mm-hmm. everybody understands how Germans are working.
Go to the Mercedes Museum.
Exactly. Show them some Porsches, tell them everything about the Autobahn. Mm-hmm. And so this is how we started on the FMX, I would say. Mm-hmm. By now, it's a few years later and we have graduated. Mm-hmm. And I still remember when we were very thrilled when they were asking us that we should hold a speech on the FMX on mm-hmm. our work.
Right.
That's also a few years ago mm-hmm. by now. And so we did that and we were super excited. But the thing that you're mentioning now with the Institut Français mm-hmm. is that last year, through this experience, we found out that there's many speakers from all over the world, many of the USA and quite a few from UK and Australia and really all over the world. And when they come visit Stuttgart, it's they're being shown around during the day. They hear a lot of nice talks and super interesting technical stuff. Mm-hmm. And at evening, we are going to the speaker's dinner.
Right.
After that, at 10 o'clock at night, they were lost a little bit,
Right.
Because us as students, we were around 20 or mm-hmm. 25 maybe, and right. Maybe they were a little bit more old, mm-hmm. So like maybe in the 35 or 40s, whatever. Right. And so, of course, we as students, we knew all the nightclubs.
Right.
If we took them there, they were kind of polite, I think.
Yeah.
But it didn't give us a chance to really talk to them anymore.
Right.
So the only thing after dinner you could do was just like going to some hotel bars or some other places like night bars. Mm-hmm. And that's not really a thrilling environment to keep on talking about
sure.
The possibilities that you might have to want to talk about with supervisors.
Right.
So last year was the first time that we really talked to Jean-Michel, mm-hmm. the new leader of the FMX. Mm-hmm. And he came to our studio to talk about the speeches that we would tell and what kind of content and where he would like to place us. And then we were also talking about that problem, in my opinion, that at night after the dinner, all the speakers maybe don't want to go to the loud parties, you know, with 180 BPM and stuff. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, what else could we do? And I said, you know, maybe there's a possibility of having something like a private lounge mm-hmm. where we just can have cocktails later on and just meet the people and just keep on talking about what happened during the day before we go to bed.
Right.
And he said, oh, you know, that's a really nice idea. We should do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay,
and
let's
try it. And since a Frenchman, he probably suggested the Institut Français, right?
It's really funny. He didn't suggest the place.
Really?
It was just, it just so happened that just, I think 2 weeks before that, I was at a premiere party,
mm-hmm.
and it was a German-French co-production.
And they
had used that room. And then I was asking, is it possible to rent this room?
Uh-huh.
And it's... perfect between the FMX building and the Maritime Hotel. It's really close.
It's just a couple blocks away. And
this is the advantage because we usually offer cocktails at this after-dinner lounge so mm-hmm. that people can drink a little bit or a little bit more and still walk back in 2 minutes to their hotel.
Yeah.
So this makes it more easy.
And also it's a private atmosphere. So all of the FMX speakers can enter,
mm-hmm.
but it's not too, you know, crowded by other people that don't have anything to do with the FMX. So mm-hmm. it's not nerdy to keep on talking about technical stuff and oculars and stuff like that.
Right,
you know?
No, it's
the HoloLens, you know, all of this world is around you.
Yep.
And if you like to, you can still elaborate on things and, mm-hmm. and discuss it.
Right.
Or you can just move on to cocktails and do a little chat about something else.
Sure.
But if you try to do that in a public space, it's much more difficult because there are so many people around you that don't have any clue what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And it's kind of impolite sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
So this is what we were trying to create, this private club with a little bit of chilled music, not too loud.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean-Michel's idea was also that we would like to have a little jam session there.
Mm-hmm.
For us as organizers, this year we're organizing it the second year with Mark Sertin and Celluloid.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little tough to organize it in a way that you have all the cocktails there and maybe no music because nobody's there to jam.
Right.
And I know that you're always taking the planes. And
sure.
So by now we have figured out a way that we are having connections to a friend who's working at the musical school and she's getting a few instruments.
Right.
It was already the case yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And it will be tonight again. The only thing is that you never can rely on if there are any, you know, musicians of the FMX crowd that really are courageous enough to enter the stage.
Right, yeah. Well, it's always a thing to be a little intimidated, especially if you're bringing big musicians in sometimes. But
that's true.
Yeah, there was at DD we are our one of the spaces that is taken over was a stage, and they just sort of converted it into a studio space that we were doing. So it's, you know, very high ceilings, etc. And there was two guys that were there. One was a Venezuelan, and the other guy was Polish. And they both played beautiful guitar. Mm-hmm. And every now and then they would, you know, in the evenings, because we were working 14-hour days at the time, they would sit down and, like, while things were rendering and were waiting for notes or whatever, they'd start playing guitar. And it was just this gorgeous guitar playing coming in the back of the studio, and it would resonate all over the place. And it's like, that's nice, you know, it was good.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really fantastic. And by now, I think everybody knows about it and they seem to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if everybody feels comfortable, I think maybe we'll have two nights next year where we don't have any musicians coming and we'll just, you know, set up the mics and a few instruments and then we see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Yeah, that'd be cool. Oh, that's great. Is there anything else you want to talk about FMX before we let you guys go?
Well, I think... FMX is really the core why we as a company even had the possibility to work together with the big features.
Yeah.
That's something that I would like to mention. And I think it's due to Thomas Hegele, Renate Hegele, who really started the FMX, you know, in our times mm-hmm. when we were studying, that we could connect through this idea of hosting speakers.
Right.
And later through all the speeches and the schedule to really... Even in Germany, which is like a tiny country in Europe and a little far away from the US and
right.
other places, really connect to the world of visual effects and animation and get the best speakers in the world to Stuttgart and really participate in what's, you know, the most recent techniques and what the future will be like for the next year at least.
Right.
So that's something that we're really grateful about.
We've always seen FMX as a great place for us in terms of, because we do a lot of events at Chaos Group, but we've always seen FMX as the key event in terms of education and a mentorship in a lot of ways. And I think that's really kind of speaks a lot to what I've seen at FMX. This was my first FMX, so it was really kind of nice.
Yeah, first one, really?
It's my first one, so it's really nice to see that. Yeah. And I, the first time I really knew anything about it, I've heard of FMX, but the first time I really knew anything, I was asking my friend at Digital Domain, his name is Steve Prigg. I actually did a podcast with him as well. And he tends to be a pretty cynical guy. He never is like, argh. But he was saying, yeah, FMX, it's like one of the best events out there. And he was explaining to me exactly how the mentorship program worked and how he got involved in that and how it was just very, very important to him to do that, because he basically made it very, you know, it made it feel like you really can do something smart and affect someone's life when you're going there, right? And you're not just going there to a couple of conferences and have drinks with your old buddies and move on. Mm-hmm. You actually get to be able to affect different people. And I think that when you have students up there and their eyes are big and hungry, mm-hmm. it's really nice to feel like you can influence someone, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember yesterday I just did my WikiHuman presentation, and there was this student, she came up to me and I was telling her how we're going to give all the data away so that people can learn from this information. And her eyes were just like, she wanted to eat it up. I was so excited to hear how excited these students are. Mm. And I was, you know, it made me feel like, you know, oh, thanks, we'll check it out. You know, it wasn't that. It was like, oh my God, you know? So it was really great to be involved with students that way. Do you guys still get involved with Film Academy at some levels as well?
We have good connections to the Film Academy,
right. Yeah,
but we do not know any students from, we are long, many years away from it.
But there must be some times when you have the opportunity to see their work or to
yeah. Yeah, there are opportunities to see it. There are some events where you can see the latest works from the different years of the Academy, and it's always nice to be there. And we have a direct connection with some developments from the Film Academy, because they develop some render and render management system, the Royal Render.
Right.
And we use this in our studio, so we get support from the developer there, sitting there, and so that's still a nice connection.
That's
to
great.
The Film Academy.
Yeah, the Royal Render, I know that one. Yeah, 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 that's great. And that's what you're using as your render farm,
yeah,
right?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, just skip back just a little. How big is your render farm?
Right now, in terms of cores, we are over 1,000 cores. I don't know exactly.
Oh, wow. So you're able to store that all here, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the machines are pretty fast. They are never too fast.
Never fast enough.
Yeah. But we have our fastest machines are 48 cores at the moment.
Right.
And people are still not satisfied using it.
Yeah, of course.
But it helps for us to render the huge amount of characters for Manu at the moment. And,
right.
Together with V-Ray.
Yeah.
It's great.
We're hoping that some of our neighbors might move out soon.
Yep, I know that feeling.
To extend the space with render farms.
I hate to say this. I hope they either become very successful very quickly or their business goes bankrupt. Something has to happen. Yeah.
Well, also the connection to Film Academy is in a way that there's, of course, two schools around here that are, you know, kind of giving us the opportunity to really select from you know, future talent.
Yeah.
They're always kind of coming here when they don't have the possibility of really going very far in the world, mm-hmm. or sometimes they just want to stay here around the area,
sure.
because they like it. And all of them are pretty good students, at least the one that we have selected to work with.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
And so that's still the network that we're drawing on. And this is also a reason why we're staying in Stuttgart, because there's the FMX coming here. You know, usually you have to travel long times to go to Seagraph or some other places.
Mm-hmm.
And also the industries around here for all the commercials, that is sometimes, you know, a little bit like cash cows.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools around here are so good.
Good artists, good funding system for us. So good support in and every aspect.
Very good mentors still, you know.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you guys came up, and this is hard. You know, you guys came up with an original script for a feature animation. You guys wrote it yourself. You figured out how you could get the right help to make it work. And you guys got the talent together, and you're sitting there producing. You've already got some funding on it and everything. That's really great. That's really, really cool that you guys are able to do that. And I think that speaks to the fact that you've got support that can help you out in those areas, right?
That's true. And also that, you know, the FMX and everything is like a future lab.
Right.
You're right on the spot. You can really tell where the visual effects is at the moment, you know. You hear all the stories, what's happening in LA, for instance, or in Vancouver or other places. And you think about exactly what you're doing here in Germany and why some people should think about working with you.
Right.
And it's something that really helps when you go to the conferences at FMX, you see where it's going.
Sure.
It's like a future lab, as I said, and there's the students and the education, and then there's the experience work that can tell you a little bit what they did past year. But then, of course, it's also like it shows you the road where it's hitting at the next, you know, level.
Right.
Where it's probably going to go, you know, next year or the year after.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we should probably get going because I think there's probably another party we have to go to.
Correct. Next speaker dinner.
Yeah, and so
the launch.
So what we always say on the end of the podcast is we always say that we're going to let the last bucket drop. You know, we were just talking about how you have that last bucket that just hangs there.
Correctly.
So we'll split this one up and let it drop. But all right, guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed the premiere of FMX in Germany.
Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.